Well, in case you're wondering, spring is gone. Of course, it left about a month and a half ago. And summer has officially arrived, which means it's time again for another edition of What's Bugging You, Red River Radio's program about our insect world with Dr. Beverly Burden, an associate professor of biology at LSUS and our resident entomologist here at Red River Radio. I'm Bill Beckett, the program director for Red River Radio, and we invite you to call in with your questions tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And if you have an insect photo, you can send it to my email address, wbeckett@lsus.edu. That's W-B-E-C-K-E-T-T @lsus.edu. Dr. Burden, glad to have you back with us for tonight's show.
I'm glad to be back, Bill. Thank you.
So we have a massive amount of photos that were actually sent into us this month. It's really kind of gratifying to see all of these photos. Some of these were submitted through Facebook, and some were sent directly to us. So let's go ahead and start out. Folks who would like to join with us, you can go to our website at redriverradio.org, and you can actually see the photographs that we're talking about. They are up on our website. All have been loaded in, and you just scroll down to the bottom of our homepage past the Young Artist Contest post up there, and you will find the What's Bugging You post. And we're going to start out with what looks like some kind of nasty stinger on that thing, some kind of wasp, I am assuming. Can you give us an idea of what that is?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite insects. It's called a scorpion fly, and one of the key characteristics of this this order is that they have an elongated face, a very, very long face on their head. Mm-hmm. And the males of this particular family look like they actually have a bulbous tail, just like a scorpion. And it's curled up just like a scorpion. And if they feel threatened, they'll raise it up just like a scorpion. But it doesn't. It's all show and no sting. Hmm. And normally when you find, they're really hard to find, but normally where you find one, you'll find two or three more. And the immatures, these are the ones that, this is a group with the immatures are like larvae. They'll just feed on organic matter, decaying organic matter. And the adults will feed on about the same. But one unique thing about the adults is that they are also attracted to dead animals, corpses. And in fact, they're well studied in forensic entomology when you're dealing with the human corpse as well. But I had this one student, she would walk along in the woods a lot, and she would find a dead wild pig or a dead deer, and she collected them in mass by those things. And she just got lucky and got on them. And so there's another actually group that's very closely related to these that are called the hanging flies, and they have a very unique mating behavior, and the fact that the females will not mate with the males unless the males give her a packet of food. And it's kind of like a dinner and a movie.
Yeah,
and there are some males that will mimic females so that they can steal the packet of food from other males and then go present it to a female themselves.
Aha! I've known guys like that.
Yeah, and so it's a really cool order. They're called the Mecopterans, and scorpion flies, hanging flies, and a really, really cool photo as well. But that male tail looking just like a scorpion, a lot of people are afraid to pick them up, but of course, you know, I'll just go right up and pick them up, and people will go, oh, are you not afraid? No, I'm not afraid.
You got experience.
But if you ever see one, look at that long, long face. That's a telltale sign of a Mecopteran.
Looks like something that you could use in a good sci-fi movie, too. So,
It does.
Now, Ed Evans submitted that, just so we get his credit out there, and it sounds like they are actually a beneficial that clean up the garbage on the forest floor.
Yeah, they are a very beneficial group, and so good for them, and good for him sending in that photo, because you don't run across of them very often. It's not that they're rare. It's just that they're not as abundant, maybe. But they're not endangered. They're not threatened or anything like that, though.
And probably not very prominent within the city or anything like that, unless you have dead, decaying organic matter.
Exactly. It's not something you'd expect to find in the urban landscape.
Right. So, yeah. Now, our next photograph was a mystery to a Gracie Glade from Florida, who is a friend of mine, and she had said, you know, I really don't know what this is. Is it a moth or is it a butterfly? And this is the second photograph down on our webpage, folks, and it's on looks like a flower pot with some wood chips in it. And, said it's somewhere in between.
Yeah, it's in between a moth and a butterfly. The family name are called Hesperidae. The common name are skippers. And one thing that gives them away, if you look at the antenna comes off the sides of the face, one on the left side and one on the right side. And this is a pretty good size skipper. I love it when people have things in their photographs that give me some kind of sense of scale. And here she has a seed packet. Looks like red pepper seeds that gives me an idea of the size. So this is a pretty large, in the common skippers. But one of the reasons that they're called skippers is because most butterflies and moths have some type of mechanism to synchronize the beating of the wings, but they do not. And so it looks like their wings are just going all over everywhere and they're just kind of skipping about. And they look like perhaps they're not strong flyers, but the immatures will feed on plants. And the immatures are caterpillars, but they look very, very distinct from almost any caterpillar you've ever seen. They have a very distinct round head capsule and then a long body that's almost transparent. And you can actually look at it and see the intestines moving and things going on inside the body. To me, they look absolutely gross. And I don't say that about very many insects, Bill. You know that.
Yes.
And one of the more common ones around here is the there's a plant that are called cannas. And there's the cannon skipper, and it will take silk and roll up the leaves and tie the leaves together so it's hidden up inside those leaves. And then when you open up that leaf, there's the big old skipper caterpillar looking right at you.
Interesting. So this could be the new Mothra, you know, if we need a new movie there. So we'll just put that out there. It's a hybrid, so we just need a giant one out there.
It is a hybrid.
Right. Now, next up, Rhonda submitted an image, and she said she took it in the morning, and her fear was it might be a dangerous hornet, and she wanted to know if you could identify.
Absolutely. Everybody that lives in this area have probably seen one of these. These are the cicada killers. They are one of the largest wasp hornet species that we have. They're solitary, so they don't live in colonies. And they will dig these vertical burrows into sandy soil, and then they'll go catch a cicada. Those things that make loud noises in the trees. Some people call them locusts, but they're not really locusts. Locusts are defined as migratory grasshoppers, which we don't have in North America anymore, thank goodness. But they'll take a cicada that's almost as big as they are, if not larger, and they'll sting it, and it just paralyzes it. Mm. And they'll carry it down into the little burrow and lay an egg on it. And when the egg hatches, the little caterpillar maggot will feed on the living cicada as it's still alive. And of course it'll eventually kill it. And these things are not aggressive at all. I've stood in the middle of six or eight of them flying around. Now if you grab one, it will sting you. And it's got a pretty large stinger on it. But if you leave them alone, they'll leave you alone. And they're a very, very important part of the urban ecological ecosystem. And so, nice picture.
Very good picture. And it looks like it has giant eyes on the back, but those are just eye spots, right? Are those for scaring things away? What's the evolutionary purpose of those?
Those are just markings.
Okay.
Yeah. I doubt if they have any adaptability or adaptive function at all.
Interesting. So, now, next up, we have Susan Wood, who said that... She had identified this. Never mind. I'm going to the next one. Lindsay Foster found this next insect on a plant of hers, and she wasn't sure it was a larvae or exactly what it was. It's an interesting kind of a grayish color. And I can't really tell whether it's a bug or a slug bug or something in between.
Yeah, if you look at this carefully, the head is pointing down toward the soil, and it's resting on the stem of a plant. And you can see the head area. The head is the one that's pointing closest to the soil. It's got an eye off to the lateral side, and you can see the segmentations of the abdomen. But up front, right behind the eye area, you can see this dark structure. That's actually the formation of what we would call a wing pad. And every time this insect molts, it is an immature, and every time this immature molts, the wing pads will grow larger and larger until finally it molts to an adult. These things are called plant hoppers, and they're one of the few insects that can walk sideways. And when I was reading her description of this on the email, she said that they would walk around the stem of the plant, if disturbed. And there's not very many insects that walk like that. And she also said that she saw it devour a spider mite, which these things are only vegetarians. At least that's the only thing that's been documented for them. And I was telling Bill, if this thing did devour a spider mite, then that would be a significant scientific record. And I would love to be a part of that. But highly unlikely. It just might have shoosh the spider mite away and given the appearance of it eating it. But I've been told stranger things. And so I don't really like to discredit our listeners, but it would be a very, very unique thing. And if she ever gets a chance to take a video of that, please do so.
Yeah.
That would be fantastic.
Or capture it and put it in a jar, and we'll go out and find some spider mites and see what happens.
Yeah, that would be another way to do it. Spider mites are so small, though.
Yeah, well, yeah. They are. So, all right, we've got our first caller online, and then we're going to get to some other photos, but we want to get to this call right away. Don from Crockett, Texas, you are on with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you tonight?
Well, I've got two questions that I'd like answered. One of them's last year, in our garden, we had some large black caterpillars, about 2 or 3 inches long, furry. And if you looked closely in between the whorls of the fur on it, the skin was red. I'm wondering if that could be identified.
I was just making some notes. Caterpillars are tough. But I like the fact that you noticed that it had the red coloration, and it had the hair, was it like in little tufts?
It was like it circled about, kind of like a woolly caterpillar.
Yeah.
That type of fur.
Okay. Well, I can't tell you exactly what kind it was, but the fact that it was black would tend to indicate to me that it was probably somewhat in the larger the butterflies. Do you know what kind of plant you saw it on?
I don't know. It was doing a number on my wife's garden. They were
Come
off. And last year I'd be driving down the road, and they're big enough you could see them walking across the line.
Yeah, they could have been swallowtail caterpillars, but they could also have been what we call hummingbird moth or sphingin moth caterpillars, because when they get ready to pupate, they will start marching across the road as well. And if it's a swallowtail caterpillar, then that would match that pretty close-like. But while I have you online, I want to use this opportunity to tell people that you need to be very, very careful with handling caterpillars that are hairy, because some of those hairs are designed to break off into your skin, and sometimes they'll also inject some toxin in there. And so you have to be very, very careful and probably just leave them alone. And, you know, caterpillars, when they're big like that, if you want to do pest control on them, just pick them off, put them in a bucket, and either throw them in the forest or do what I call mechanical control and just stomp on them or something. But it sounds like it might also be a tussock moth. But there are some caterpillars that are very picky about the plants they feed on. There are some caterpillars that are generalist feeders, and so it just depends on what kind of plants that was in your wife's garden. Okay. What was your other question,
okay.
Don?
Another thing, last time I listened to the show, you were talking with a gentleman about how to control fleas.
Uh-huh.
I passed on something that my wife uses that involves bugs on both ends. She orders a type of nematodes, and she sprays those in the yard. I'm not exactly certain where she gets them. She says you have to get a special type, and it goes in like a hose sprayer. You put it in and spray it down in the yard, and then keep the yard wet for a couple of days. And we don't have fleas all year long.
That's great.
Spring. So that might be something people looking to control fleas might look into.
Well, definitely, a lot of people, when they start to control fleas, they just focus on the inside of the house because that's where they tend to be bothered by them. But you absolutely have to control them out in the yard as well. And so that's a really good thing. Now, let me explain to our listening audience, perhaps that they may not know what nematodes are. Nematodes are classified as roundworms. It's a very, very diverse group. It's probably close to being the second largest order. Lots and lots and lots of different roundworms. Same thing as, not same thing, but roundworms that people might have heard about are perhaps hookworms or pinworms. These are parasites of human beings. But there are a lot of nematodes, roundworms that are parasites of insects. And it's an excellent way to control certain types of insects when you absolutely cannot use any type of insecticide in the area. For example, up north in Wisconsin, I had a good friend that was working on using nematodes to control these little flies that were inhabiting the cranberry bogs. And you certainly don't want insecticides in the cranberry bogs. And also in mint leaves as well. And so nematodes are really, really good. It's called biological control, which is using one organism to control another. And that's exactly what Mother Nature does. And the USDA and agriculturalists try to use biological control anytime they can. So we don't overuse pesticides. And so thanks a lot for sharing that with me, Don. That makes my heart happy to know that your wife is using nematodes to control fleas with.
Our dogs are in and out of the house. They started to get fleas earlier this spring, and she ordered the nematodes to put them out, and there's no problem with them at all. And again, we haven't used any insecticides at all.
So. Exactly. And a lot of people prefer it that way. It is considered to be an organic form. And so thank you for sharing that with our listening audience tonight, Don. And thanks for calling.
Thank you.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have all lines open now. And in the meantime, we still have some photos to go through. As I said, we had received a huge number of photos. Now, the next photograph is, she took the picture correct. It's up against a penny, and these are tiny insects that are you could probably fit 10 of them on this penny, so they're not very big. You had identified these already.
Yeah, these are just immature little cockroaches. They probably just hatched out recently. And until they get a little bit larger, it would be very difficult to tell you whether it was a German cockroach or an American cockroach or what kind of cockroach it is. But when cockroaches first hatch out, they are extremely, extremely small, but then it doesn't take them very long to grow in size as well. And so that's what we have here, Bill.
Okay. And now we have a number of photographs that was submitted by Sarah Knotts, who lives here in Shreveport. And she works, in an office, and it's kind of overnight. She has some friends in there, but they're not humanoid. So let's go to the first one of these. This is looks like a butterfly or a moth, and she saw that up against the wall.
Okay. This is a moth. You can tell moths from butterflies because their bodies tend to be, in that size, a little bit more robust. She has a paperclip down by it. It's a beautiful orange with the yellow speckles on it. This is in the family that we know as Arctiidae, and they tend to be white, yellowish in color, and just a beautiful, beautiful specimen. We do have a few of these in the LSUS insect collection. And, of course, it's appropriate that she saw it at night, because that's also one of the major differences between moths and butterflies. Moths are nocturnal and butterflies are diurnal. And she even has a little bitty of ground beetle or a scarab beetle that's tucked halfway down the door as well. And so beautiful, beautiful moth. And that's why we love for you guys to send us in these pictures. And to give it a common name, I'll have to do a little bit more research on that. With moths, it's better just to identify them by color patterns on the leaves, on the wings. But you can also go by wing venation, but that's very, very difficult because, of course, we know that moths and butterflies have those scales on their wings, and that what gives them those beautiful colors and beautiful patterns.
Hmm. And then next up we have... Well, this looks like something out of a sci-fi film as well. It looks like some kind of, it almost looks like it's got horns on it.
I think I got some of these a little out of order, but that's okay. I'm glad you gave me a cue there, because I was about to talk about the click beetle.
Yeah, no.
Okay, this is a large scarab beetle. Scarabs are extremely diverse. We do find these locally. Sometimes they'll go by the name of rhinoceros beetle because it has these large horns on its head, just like a rhinoceros does. But they're plant feeders. But the males who have the horns on their head will use these to joust with other males to gain favor of mating with the female. And so this is one of the largest beetles that we have in the Arklatex area. And I absolutely, positively love them because, one, scarabs are one of my favorite beetles, and beetles are basically my favorite to begin with. And so, beautiful, beautiful specimen.
It's got a nice glossy back on it and splotchy little colors. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of cute for a bug that you think would also be a good sci-fi flick.
Yeah, it's pale green in color with black speckles on it and with black legs, and the horns are black and... beautiful, beautiful specimen.
All right, and next up we have a pretty little bug. This looks like it's actually almost like on the back of a chair or something because of the background, but its wings are all folded up and it's colorful, but what is this?
It's a type of moth, and I do not know if I've ever seen this particular moth before that have come into the collection. But there's lots of things out there that I have not seen. But it's got beautiful pink little legs. And then the wings are pink with a band of yellow with pink. And then the prothorax looks like it's got a beautiful yellow hoodie on it. And I think it's on a cardboard box, actually, Bill.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that could be. Yeah.
You can see the variations up at the top. And I will have to do some more research on this, but and that's another thing. It's hard to tell size on this particular one, and so I will do my research on that, and I will get that back to Bill, and he can put it on the web page as soon as we can make that happen.
And here's a suggestion: if you happen to see this again, Sarah, go ahead and see if you can't capture it in a jar. You know, don't hurt it, but it might make a good addition to the specimen or to the collection here at LSUS. Mm. So,
yeah, Bill, that reminds me. You have to. A lot of people will bring me organisms, creepy crawlies, squiggly wigglies, and sometimes now that we no longer have a full-time vertebrate biologist on staff, I'll get snakes and lizards and everything. I'm kind of the catch-all for all organismal biology these days. And I'll say, I'll be glad to take this specimen. And they'll back up and they'll say, you said specimen. That means you're going to kill it. And I said, well, you know, you can't really return things back to the wild. If you want to take it and turn it loose, that's fine. But if you want to give it to me, yes, it will become a specimen. Yeah. And I don't, you have to realize that with the diversity and the number of insects and organisms out there, I pretty much know what is rare and what isn't rare. And if it's going to be a threatened or a rare thing, I'm going to say we need to get this back out.
Right.
But we are not going to decimate and threaten the insect community if I take one little moth here or there. And so I wanted to share that with the listeners so they don't worry about that.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. And we do have lines open right now. We're running down our list of photographs. I know it's fascinating, but you can call in right now and get on the hold, and we will answer your questions as quickly as possible. 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 for tonight's show. And once again, Sarah Knotts, now you had said something earlier that migratory grasshoppers are no longer here in the United States. Is that because we're keeping them in check, or is that a species has died out or gone away?
I can't answer that for certain, but this summer and this spring, there has been massive outbreaks of migratory grasshoppers in Africa, and to the point where it's severely encumbered and hurt the economy way mm-hmm. more than COVID-19. And because when migratory grasshoppers come into an area, they will eat every living thing down to the ground, and then they will move off. Now, the weird thing about migratory grasshoppers is that they're not always migratory. They will be in an area, the grasshoppers will be in an area, and then when the food starts to become scarce, the next generation will grow bigger wing muscles so that they can take on these huge mm-hmm. migratory flights. And they're also very common in China, and they've been able to chart these things with Doppler radar.
Now go ahead.
Yeah, it's just been so huge. Now, back in the mid-1800s in the United States, especially in the western part, a little bit east of the Rocky Mountains, say like in Nebraska, the Dakotas, and yet over in Utah and Idaho, there were migratory grasshopper plagues. It is a plague component, what's interesting that in Salt Lake City there used to be a statue there of a woman holding up a gull in tribute to the gull, because they had a huge migratory grasshopper infestation, and seagulls came out of nowhere and ate all the grasshoppers and saved the crops. And we haven't had a migratory grasshopper problem in this country, I don't think, since
the Dust Bowl.
Probably precluding the Dust Bowl days of the 1930s. And so I would have to consult somebody that might know a little bit more about that, but I just know the history of it. And did you want to talk about the picture of the little grasshopper?
Yeah, well, I was curious whether the Dust Bowl caused the locust or the locust caused the Dust Bowl. Do you have a cause and effect there?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No.
Yeah. Well, let's go on to this picture then again by Sarah Knotts. And guess what? It's a grasshopper.
Yeah, let me find that little guy. There he is. It's an immature grasshopper. And you can tell an immature grasshopper because they don't have fully developed wing pads, and you can see the segmentation of the abdomen. But she got a really good profile shot mm-hmm. of the it's a little green grasshopper with medium length antenna. You can see the little kind of a golden eyes there with the big jumping legs in the back. And there are three subfamilies of grasshoppers that you can easily tell, and I love showing this to kids because after that, they'll go around catching grasshoppers and identifying them to subfamily. And the subfamily that I know this one is not is called the slant face grasshopper. If you look at a grasshopper profile and the face is slanted almost at a 45-degree angle, then that's the subfamily of slant-faced grasshoppers. If it doesn't have a slant face, flip it over and look in the neck area, and there might be a little protrusion there. It looks like a little finger sticking up out of the neck area, and these are called spur-throated grasshoppers. And if it's not a spur-throated and it's not a slant-faced grasshopper, then you can't really tell for sure until it grows its wings out. But the hind wings, grasshoppers have two pairs of wings. The front wings are kind of tough and leather-like, and they protect the delicate flight wings that are underneath that. And if you look at the flight wings, they will have a color band at the base. And even if you can't capture them, if you've ever been walking out in a meadow and you have flushed some grasshoppers up out of the grass, and when they fly about, they make this crackling noise.
Mm-hmm.
Those are also banded wing grasshoppers, and they either make the crackling noise and or they'll have the banded wings, and that's how you can tell the subfamily. So all the kids that are listening out there, and I find this has been really cool too, since the shutdown and some people are sheltering in place and working from home, people are getting out more.
Mm-hmm.
They're going, you know, outside walking. They're going out in their backyards, and they're looking at things, and they're getting away from the video games. They're getting away from the television, and people are discovering a lot more than they've ever really knew that was out there before, and they're having a greater appreciation of nature. And it's endearing to me. I see kids out riding bicycles again, and you know, adults out walking in the evening. And so people are being exposed more and more to nature than we've had in years past. And I think that's if there's anything good that comes out of this COVID-19, I think that would be a plus.
That reminds me, I'm having flashbacks to a Simpson cartoon where I forget what exactly happened, but, you know, somehow the TV and all of that was shut off, and all of a sudden you look out the window and you hear the morning mood from Peer Gynt from Grieg's suite, and you see all the kids out there skipping rope and playing and stuff like that instead of zoning out in front of the TV. So maybe that's a good thing for our society. So now next up, we're going to skip over, well, unless you want to address this other moth-like creature that Sarah got, which looks very similar to the first one that we had, only these wings are more extended.
And it may just be age, mm-hmm. because these scales with age sometimes brush off and it loses some of its vibrant color.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would guess that that's just an older moth of the same species, where the other one was a younger moth, still an adult, because if they have wings, they're adults. If they don't have, if they're caterpillars, they don't have wings, they're not adults. And so I would assume that it, and sometimes you can have some sexual dimorphism, where the males may be a little bit brighter colored than the females, mm-hmm. are. Very similar to what you sometimes find in the bird world.
Mm-hmm.
The males will be brighter colored, and so the little one that's brightly colored may be a male. This might be a female, so we call that sexually dimorphic. And so age or gender, that's what I'm going for.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, and we're going to be opening up the lines here, 800-552-8502. We just have a couple of more photos to take care of, and then we'll be able to take all of your calls. So fill up those phone lines right now, but give Wally Derleth a break back there. He's the only one on the phone line. So 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we're going to go next to two photographs, both sent in by Jessica Poor from up in Farmersville, but these were taken out in Taos, New Mexico. She was out there spending a little time, a little downtime out there. And the first one looks like it's on a beautiful, beautiful flower. Almost looks like a cactus within a flower. And what is that kind of? It's a type of bee.
Yeah, I would guess that it's just your average honeybee, Apis mellifera, attracted to this beautiful desert flower. And and we've gotten a lot of inquiries about bees lately, so let me spend a little bit of time about, mm-hmm. bees. Maybe somebody might want to call in and talk to me a little bit more about bees. That would be fine with me. But bees and wasps, some live in colonies, so we say that they're colonial, but a lot of them are solitary. And so honeybees obviously are colonial, and we love our honeybees because we know that they're important pollinators and the system. But sometimes they can be a pest when they set up house and when they set up their colonies too close to a house, or perhaps even inside the void walls of a house, then they can become a pest. But in general, if insects live in a colony, they may be a little bit more aggressive than if they're solitary. And so that's something you need to take into account when you're dealing with wasps and bees that might be a nuisance problem in your yard. Bees can be very hard to identify, especially some of the ones that are solitary, because you just don't see them very often, as well as the hornets. And so just be very careful about the bees.
Mm-hmm. And then the next one with the white bands.
Yeah, this is on some kind of a purple flower.
Beautiful flower.
Yeah. I would have no idea to tell you what kind of a flower that is, but it reminds me a little bit. It's on a stalk, and so it kind of reminds me a little bit of Texas bluebonnets, but it's much larger than that. And the bee in this particular picture has black and almost white-ish, light yellow bands on them with a very light thorax. I don't ever recall seeing a bee like this. This might be a little bit more endemic to the southwestern part of the United States. Mm-hmm. I do have some people that are entomologists in Arizona. I could probably shoot this too. They may be able to help me out a little bit more. But here's the thing I love about pictures like this, Bill. People will look at this and they'll focus right in on that bee.
Mm-hmm.
What they didn't see is just to the left of it is a little fly.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually have this still life painting I've rediscovered at my house. I think I'm going to take it into the office. And I got this because if you look close, you can count up to, I think it was a dozen or 13 different insects in that picture. But you have to look close because it's just sometimes they're so well hidden and camouflaged. And so obviously this bee looks like it's pollinating. And so that's pretty cool as well.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton, and we hope you'll call in right now at 800-552-8502. We're through all of our photographs tonight. And the only thing we have left, and I don't have this video up, but I will put it up because we weren't sure we were going to be able to get to this, but it is a video that's floating around on Facebook, and it is of some kind of mass migration of tiny little insects all in a line, all rolling across a street, and there was lots of different speculations about this. These were maggots or something like that, but you had passed this off to Dr. Lee Townsend at the University of Kentucky in Lexington, and he shared his expertise with you.
Yeah, these pictures were actually taken by a news station out of Toledo, Ohio, and they are called fungus gnat larvae, and fungus gnat larvae normally feed on decaying organic material. And what Dr. Townsend told me is that they tend to be found in areas of very thick turf with a lot of hatch buildup in it, with very poor drainage circulation, which makes completely sense because we know that fly larvae need a lot of drainage or moist area to live in. And apparently when they get ready to pupate, and this is not uncommon among flies at all, when they get ready to pupate, they will crawl away from wherever they've been feeding and they will find a different location to pupate and then make the transition from a maggot to an adult fly. And so you'll have that up on the webpage, Bill?
Yes.
It's pretty neat. I thought it was, at first I thought maybe there were just small army worms that were migrating, but I never heard of these before, and like I said, I learned something every month that I do this show, something new. And that's why it never gets old.
It was really interesting. It looks like, again, something, you know, I love old sci-fi movies. So it looks like something out of an old sci-fi movie. So you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist. And by gosh, we're through all these photographs. We know we've mesmerized you now, but we want you to call in with your questions tonight. 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Get your kids to call in and ask about insects, too, because it's a great time to educate your kids. And in the meantime, some goofy questions here. You know, I love old sci-fi movies. So in Mothra, what was the moth?
Are you talking about Mothra as in Mothra and Godzilla?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. You know, that... that movie is very, very, I love that movie because it does contain this large insect, and it's very, very biologically correct, because when the caterpillar was releasing silk out of its mouth, they actually have silk glands, modified salivary glands, that are used as silk glands. And so it's been a long time since I've seen that movie, but it is absolutely anatomically and biologically correct, which is not surprising at all, because the Japanese culture has a love affair with entomology and with insects. It's much more prevalent, and it's a hobby for people to raise insects and to interact with insects and to actually fight crickets and do many other different things. And so the moth was, it looked like a large Arctid moth, almost like the one in the picture that your friend sent, that beautiful kind of a tan moth with the yellow specks.
Yeah.
I'll have to turn around and look at that movie again.
I, you know, when I want to zone out and go brain dead, I go to back to those old B movies. So because it's just so campy and fun to watch. So we have callers finally, and thank you very much. I think we did mesmerize them with all that conversation, which is cool. You know, I love the photographs because they really bring out things to you. You know, it's hard to describe things verbally sometimes, but boy, an image does wonders. And we have our first caller on, Cheryl Williams from El Dorado. You are on with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you?
Hello. How are you all this evening?
We're good.
Good.
We are pleased to note that we are having a larger number of fireflies this year than we have seen. And it's not the swarm of magical swarm of my childhood, but we started seeing them again last year. We noticed more. And then this year, they seem to be even more abundant. We are surrounded by lots of shrubs and bushes in kind of a wooded area behind us. And I have just read an article that claims that fireflies may be disappearing in part because of too many lights being left on, among other things, of course, pesticides, et cetera, et cetera. But I wonder if you have noticed more fireflies, and if so, do you have an explanation?
I have some guesses. I have started noticing. I started noticing them last year.
Yeah.
I drive home on the same route to and from the university every day, and I tend to go home pretty much just as it's getting dark. Fireflies are most active right at the dusk-dark interphase. And what a lot of people don't realize is that the fireflies that you see are only the males. And what's happening, the males are flying, and you notice that they'll fly probably just 4 or 5 feet above the soil, above the ground.
Right.
And there's our female fireflies that are wingless, that are down in the vegetation. And the males, each species have their own individual flash patterns. And so the males will flash, let's say he's species A, he'll flash down to species A female, she will return the flash pattern, and then he will go down and they will mate. And some of the, there are two different groups of things that are called glowworms, but female fireflies also go by the name glowworm because they look like little caterpillars that are glowing. And the flashing that they do is actually a chemical reaction. There is a compound in the abdomen of of the fireflies called, and this is kind of cool, luciferin, and an enzyme called luciferin A's will cause a chemical reaction, and scientists have studied this chemical reaction because it's almost a perfect, hardly any heat is lost. It's almost a 100% efficient a light-emitting system. And that just doesn't exist outside of Mother Nature very often. And so I think it's because, one, people are getting smart, and we're not just spraying pesticides just to be spraying pesticides anymore. And we're spraying smarter pesticides. We're spraying more pyrethrins that have limited toxicity. And I also think that it could be, you know, city lights, but I've never really heard that as a viable explanation, because, you know, I've seen fireflies in mid-city parks, but it could be a lighting situation, but whatever it is, welcome back, fireflies.
Yes, indeed.
No kidding. They are beautiful. One thing this article said, and it didn't offer concrete evidence, but it said that excessive light could interfere with their mating habits, which would kind of go along with what you said.
It would very much go along with what I said. And there's also a system down in Florida where you'll have a female of species B that will learn to mimic the flash pattern of the female of species A. And then when the male comes down to mate, she'll eat and devour him. It's almost like the nature femme fatale. And you know, I tell my students all the time, Hollywood cannot make this stuff up any better than Mother Nature did. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, yeah. it, you can't make this stuff up. It's too cool.
It is cool. It's exciting, too, isn't it?
Thank you so much for your call.
Oh, sure. Thank you for taking it.
You betcha. Now, I'm curious if there's folks who live way out in the country, whether they see fireflies often, or is it diminished all around? Because the light... you know, example, you know, probably wouldn't hold if you're out in the middle of, say, you know, a state park or something like that, where you're literally in the woods.
Sure.
and you don't see that. So that would be a good question to answer for those who are living out in the country.
Yeah.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We do have a couple of callers online. Barbie, please hold on. John from Fishville, you are up next. What's bugging you?
Hey,
John, turn your radio down, or otherwise we're going to have a heck of an echo there.
I don't have my radio on at all.
Oh, it's flashing back through the phone.
I'll be darned. Well, that's kind of crazy.
Yep.
Well, let's see. Well, anyway, whatever happened to the seven-year locust? About 35, 40 years ago, I live out here in the swamps. The locusts were, well, you could not even be out at night and carry on a conversation. They were just roaring loud. And that's when they said, well, they just come around every 7 years. But that didn't happen maybe one or two more times, and now we don't have those locusts. So wonder what happened.
Well, I can tell you a couple of things. One is the locusts that we have here in this area are annual locusts. They come out every year. Now, there are what they call 13 and 17-year broods. I've never heard of the 7-year locust before. That only come out every 13 and 17 years. And these are highly geographically isolated. The closest brood of 13-year cicadas that we have in this area is going to be over in southeast Oklahoma. But we don't have, you know, a periodical 7-year locust here.
Well, I could be missed, you know, that's what I recall. But
yeah,
now that you mention it, I think it was 13 years, yeah.
And so they might have been in this area at one point and not anymore, but that would have been quite a long time ago. And I'd have to go back through the records to verify that. But
hey, can I add something to the previous caller about the fireflies?
Sure.
I've got a story. I'll be as quick as I can. I was down in Nicaragua. I was flying a helicopter for the Doctors with No Borders.
Mm-hmm.
And I got stuck out on the mountainside one night, and I had to just shut the aircraft down, and I was just up the cliff from a village. And it got dark, and the fireflies, I just couldn't believe. And it turned out it wasn't even fireflies. It was a comet shower.
Oh, my.
It was Halley's Comet, and it was one of the most active Halley's Comets in history. And I thought there was fireflies. I just had to throw that in for you guys.
That's fascinating.
Well, being that close to the equator, that would make more sense. You know.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if that tail gets up in there, the upper atmosphere.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was just, I just had to throw that in with the firefly thing.
Thank you for sharing.
All right. Hey, keep up the good work, guys.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We still have time for your calls. And Barbie from Pineville, you are up next. What's your question? What's bugging you tonight?
I seen one of the most coolest bugs, and what made it caught our attention because its antenna was about an inch and a half long, and it was at the end. We had just weed-eated, and those stickers that grow in the wild between the buildings and stuff, it was at the end of one of those. Its body was only, I don't know, about 2 inches long, and the middle of it was a mottled brown, but on each side of its back, it had a lime green stripe. It was so cool.
And you said it had a, was the antenna about the half the length of the body or greater than the length of the body?
It was just a little bit under, because when we first saw it, I thought it was a walking stick. And I started looking at it again. It's like, no, that ain't no walking stick, because it ain't that long.
Uh-huh. Yeah, walking sticks don't have that long of an antenna. But it sounds to me what you're describing is called a longhorn wood-boring beetle. And they have extremely long antenna, and they can get beautiful, beautifully colorations, especially sometimes even metallic colors.
It was almost a metallic lime green.
Yeah. Yeah, then that would go true with that.
And its whole body was maybe 3/8 of an inch across.
Yeah. Was it round in shape? The body was rounder in shape than flatter?
He was kind of long, but he was kind of flat but fat.
Okay. Yep. Longhorn wood-boring beetle, it sounds to me. They're very host-specific, and you normally don't find them down in vegetation like that, so you got lucky to see a great insect at a place where you probably wouldn't expect to see that. Excellent.
I mean, it was so cool.
Next time, take a picture and send it to Bill Beckett at River Radio, and we can discuss your cool insect with a photograph next month.
By the time I went in to get my phone, he was gone.
Yeah, it happens to me all the time.
Yep.
All the time. To Bill, too. Thank you for your call, Barbie.
Thank you.
You are listening. You too. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton, and we still have some time, and the phone lines are completely free right now. So we're going to do an update on a couple of invasive species that we've talked about over the past few years. Any news on the Formosa termite that has, I believe that was primarily in South Louisiana, was it?
Yeah, things have kind of quieted down on that, so I'm not real sure about the status. They must be able to keep them in check. There for a long time, they were quite a threat to some of the older historical buildings and New Orleans. But I'm glad to say that things have quieted down, because, you know, all of these invasive species just drive us biologists crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every time we turn around, something new is being introduced. And And we're supposed to have safeguards in place for that, but things just don't always work the right way, Bill.
And, you know, on Facebook, I follow a lot of folks, and I've got a lot of friends who are into, you know, all kinds of different environmental things. And there was a discussion not too long ago about the modification of mosquitoes that I believe you're genetically modifying them so that they kind of screw up the breeding pattern of the dangerous mosquitoes that can spread Zika and yellow fever or malaria. I'm not sure which one it is because I don't know the difference between the two. And also some other diseases. Can you tell us about that and whether or not, you know, really, you know, because you hear genetic modification of nature and people kind of freak out and they see giant monster, you know, mosquitoes coming to, you know, eat their children and stuff. So.
Yeah, it was a modification of a technique that was developed years and years ago called the sterile male technique. And they go in and they modify so that the males do not produce viable sperm, but the females think that they have mated and that it was successful mating, and then they don't lay viable eggs. And so it's, like I said, a lot of people don't like the fact that things are genetically modified. But I don't like the fact that people are dying of these diseases that are being transmitted by mosquitoes either.
So it's almost like spaying and neutering your pet in a way.
It is.
You know, but of course their genitalia are different, so it's not that easy as spaying or neutering your pet. You're just going in and basically removing a part of their genetic structure that allows them to create viable sperm.
Right.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. We do have phone lines open and a few more minutes, and we'll just go on to, are there any invasive insects right now that are coming into the United States that are new that we need to either be concerned about or be on the lookout for, or what's going on the global system?
Well, we talked about this a little bit last month, but rumors are still abounding about this large hornet that has come over from Asia, and it's in the specific northwestern part of the United States and Canada. And these things are absolutely harmless to people, but anybody, if you put the word hornet and murder in the same sentence, people are going to be very concerned very fast. And so they are a serious threat, though, to honeybees, because that's the ones that they will hover around the hives of honeybees. And as the workers come out to forage for pollen and for nectar and for food, they will basically bite the heads off and then carry the thorax, which is very rich in flight muscle, and eat that. And so I just want to take the opportunity to say that don't panic when you hear people talking about the giant Asian murder hornet, because it's not a threat to humans at all.
All right. I had suggested we train them all to eat mosquitoes, which would be a good idea. So
yeah,
I don't know how you train hornets. So
I don't either.
Well, you have been listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton. And we want to thank everybody who called in tonight, and especially those who submitted pictures. Wally Derleth was on our phones tonight. We want to thank him for helping out. We didn't keep him too busy tonight. Dr. Beverly Burton and Bill Beckett are the producers of this show, and Beverly Burton is our resident entomologist here at LSUS and at Red River Radio. And this program will be up on our website in just a few hours here at Red River Radio, and you can tune in next month for the next edition of What's Bugging You and Bird Calls. The next edition of Bird Calls will be on July 14th. And What's Bugging You on July 21st. Tune in for Health Matters this Thursday night at 6 o'clock here on Red River Radio. And stay tuned. Radio Lab is up next here on Red River Radio.